Welcome to Ungagged. On this podcast, we have Laura Lundahl with a piece on Britain's role in Hong Kong, how did past British actions contribute to this year's protests, and Emma Dehaney with a considered contribution, Let's Be Positive. It's a good theory, really. I like being positive. And we have Keith Stoddart, who talks to our Neil Anderson about the People's Assembly, and me, Deborah Torrance from Ogai. This time on Ungagged, our brief was The Spectacle. At the time, I had just been Googling motion sickness goggles, and it felt quite apt. I feel sick with the perpetual whirlwind of politics and current affairs right now. It truly is a spectacle to behold. Maybe a monocle, the way our country is descending into Jacob Rees-Mogg's neo-feudalism. The world right now is an absolute chaos. Listen to Laura and what's happening in Hong Kong. Reading here from Nathalia Urban and what's going on in Brazil. Reading here from all our contributors all around the world. And it's not hard to start to despair. There's a loch on the top of the ice at the top of the world right now, and has been for a few years in a row. There's fires in the Arctic in Canada, fires in Siberia, fires in Brazil. There's oceans full of plastic and human waste. Insects that we rely on to pollinate our food are becoming sick from chemicals that we spray on the crops. There's records being broken by heat, flood and storm capacity, wind speed records, drought records. It's almost as if the planet is trying to tell us something. On top of this global ecological catastrophe, we have political disasters happening everywhere. There's journalists and activists under attack from India to Indiana. There's indigenous communities being decimated in the name of capitalism, corporate greed and the betterment of mankind. Except, is continued exponential growth really our salvation? Governance is a spectacle, isn't it? A great big show. An illusion of power until the power must be forced. Who really holds the power? It's obviously no us. I mean, we keep hearing about these 17 million people in the UK who voted for Brexit. But what about the other two-thirds of the country? Brexit isn't just going to affect those who vote. I knew a lassie who didn't register to vote because she had catalogue debt and was scared that by registering, they'd come after her for money. She's got two wains and a Spanish husband. I think Brexit might have already impacted her family. We're saying democracy is dead, but in reality, this is our democracy. A monarchy commanding a government, but not really. Men in cloaks with big sticks banging on doors and chairman of the Privy Council going to a castle to go through the formality of asking the Queen for an archaic mechanism to be enacted. Proroguing of Parliament. I'll let that sit with you for a moment. Let it marinate. That language is so far removed from how I communicate. I don't know about you lot, but the actions of these elected men of international resolve are so abhorrent to my moralities. I even just said the word lol out loud. I can't comprehend the word that the world that the upper echelons of society must exist in, these guys, because it's not the same world as the rest of us, I don't think. If you have been to the supermarket recently and noticed, oh, why are those razors I always buy now nearly a tenner? Maybe I won't shave for a week. Or noticed that the cereal you always buy is no longer just 2 quid, but doubled in price. You probably live in the same world as me. If you feel guilty when you put the wrong item in the recycle bin and will dig through your own waste to get it out and into the right receptacle, only for the council not to collect the bin that week, you live in the same world as me. Maybe you panic when you get a brown envelope with a wee window in it. Maybe you're an immigrant or sick or on the brew or maybe all the things. That wee envelope could be a mandatory reassessment. see if your amputated limb's grown back? If so, we live in the same world. So this world, the real world, I would call it, because I'm a child of MTV. Throwback to the 90s when Tony Blair told us, things can only get better. And what a laugh that was, eh? Millions marched on the streets back then too to protest the Iraq war. That showed those in power, eh? We've chosen this. Humans, I mean. As a species. We've allowed this model of democracy. Because remember, Westminster is the mother of all parliaments. Well, folks, I think Mummy's not home right now, or she's on the sherry. And there's going to be an empty at Whitehall, and everybody's invited. We need to trash the system before it trashes us. I want a socially just and more equal republican democratic society. I don't think that's too much to ask for. I want ecological policies to try and save the planet, and I don't want weapons of mass destruction on the Clyde. If only there was some radical way to achieve these things. I mean, I don't want to see the continued rise of fascism. I don't want war. I'm not into totalitarian regimes or religious animosity. I like to think that the vast majority of folk who live in the same world as me also don't want these things. So what do we do? Do we march? Do we take our wrath to those who we disagree with on petty things, or do we all come together and try and fight the big things? Please, like, what do we do? Can we unite in our humanity? Can we unite for the ecosystem that we share, this planet? Please, somebody, just anybody, just tell us. On Facebook, on Twitter, @_ungagged and leftungagged.org. Get in touch. Let's do something. There's music to contemplate too from Joe Solo with The Day the War Came Home. My friend Leanne Louise with her song War Torn. And Crystallize up now with Voxen.
First thing I remember is fire, light burned, an ending, a nightmare haunting earthly desire. Shrouded mystical signs, black shards taunting. It's poison, danger seeping inside. Smoke clouds. peace. Crystal cracking planetary lemon and violent dreams. Harsh and twisted, ever watching, I am done with making peace. Through crystal eyes.
Lundahl here. I live in Shenzhen, China, which you may have seen recently on the news. Shenzhen is on the border with Hong Kong, and after a summer of protests in the latter, the Chinese government has sent large numbers of police forces to Shenzhen as either a show or preparation. Or both. I haven't seen them, as they're in a different district than I live in. My daily life hasn't changed in the slightest, as I tell the many people who have asked. As a side note, remember our December podcast called The People's Voice, when I talked about how I always seem to end up living where the major world news stories are? Here we go again. These protests certainly fall in line with this month's ungagged theme of the spectacle. From a percentage of population standpoint, these are quite possibly the largest protests in world history. 2 million people out of the city's 7 million came out one weekend. That's nearly 30% of the population out on the streets. Obviously, protests like this could never happen in Shenzhen or anywhere else in mainland China. Or, well, okay, they did happen once 30 years ago, and we all know what happened there. Or should I say, we know. My Chinese coworkers do not. But anyways. While Hong Kong is a Chinese city, it exists under a one-country, two-systems system. I go every few weeks to run errands and have to go through passport control to get there and then to get back to mainland China. It's a great city. But I'm not going to talk about the protests, as I live in China and, well, don't really want to deal with that. But what I will talk about is what I always talk about, the asinine British immigration system and how that relates to what is currently happening in Hong Kong. As a quick reminder, Britain colonized Hong Kong during the First Opium War in 1841 and held on to it later than nearly any other colony. Most of the overseas territories gained their independence in the post-war years, but Hong Kong remained under British control until 1997, when it was handed back over to China with the promise that Hong Kong would be relatively free for at least 50 years. There's a lot of animosity between mainland China and Hong Kong. As a general rule, Hong Kongers tend to look down on mainland Chinese. They don't really want to be associated with them. And mainland Chinese people think of Hong Kongers as arrogant and unfriendly as a result. In a 2017 identity poll, only 3% of Hong Kong residents aged 18 to 29 view themselves as broadly Chinese. When the handover occurred 22 years ago, that percentage was 31%. That is an insane collapse in numbers. As one young person told Reuters, "I feel as though I'm half a British citizen." As I talked about in Ungag's last episode, this idea of feeling British echoes what many people from the various colonies have said about the so-called mother country. Unfortunately, Britain has never viewed those they colonized as British. As I also said last time, British citizenship and residency rights granted to those from the former colonies has been quite limited. Between 1948 and 1962, there was unrestricted access to the UK for anybody who lived in a British colony or territory. This access was granted because the UK needed help rebuilding after the war. By 1971, around 3 million immigrants were living in the UK, mainly from either the Commonwealth or Europe. However, as I mentioned last time, the British public was horrified at these new arrivals. This despite the fact that actually more British people left the country than those who came, for places like Canada or Australia. But they're expats, right? Anyways, to appease an angry electorate, in 1962 saw the passage of the first Commonwealth Immigration Act, which restricted Commonwealth immigration to those who had been granted government-issued work vouchers. This allowed the government to control the numbers of those who came. Further acts were passed, and by 1971, the only way a Hong Kong resident could move to the UK was if they, their husband, only husbands, not wives, so if they, their husband, their parents, or their grandparents were somehow connected with the UK. But it was the British Nationality Act of 1981 that really saw massive changes to British citizenship and paved the way for many of the issues people are facing today. One of the major changes that came with this act was that it got rid of birthright citizenship. Ever since the act's implementation in 1983, the children of non-citizen immigrants are not granted citizenship and are thus subject to the same overinflated fees and horrid treatment from the Home Office as is everyone else. You may have recently seen the story on the news about Bumi Thomas, a Glaswegian-born woman of Nigerian descent, who the Home Office tried to deport. She was born a few months after this act was implemented, and thus no longer eligible for British citizenship like her older sister had been. However, the family didn't know, and thus never secured her a passport, and now at age 35, the government wants her gone. The reason that this happened to Bumi, and so many others, is because of the 1981 Nationality Act, which completely redefined British citizenship and nationality. One of the main criticisms of this act, then and now, was that it was suspected to have been drawn up specifically to ensure that Hong Kongers did not immigrate to the UK. Negotiations between Britain and China regarding the handover of Hong Kong had begun a couple of years earlier, and the government wanted to ensure that there wasn't a mass exodus of people fleeing the authoritarian Chinese government. Harming other immigrants was just a happy side effect for the government. The Nationality Act changed the legal status of those living in territories such as Hong Kong from British subjects to British dependent territories' citizens. This meant that while they were still British nationals, they were subject to immigration control and had no right to live or work in the UK. While prior to the act it had been more difficult to immigrate to the UK, it was this that saw the doors basically shut. While one could argue that this was fair enough for other Commonwealth countries who had gained independence from the UK, Hong Kong was still firmly under British control at the time. Meanwhile, in the 1990s, Tony Blair and Labour campaigned on the promise to reinstate the right to live and work in the UK to the colonies, but once in office, he did absolutely nothing to change the system. At the same time as the handover was being negotiated and the British Nationality Act was passed, Portugal was doing similar negotiations with China over their colony, Macau. Macau is similar to Hong Kong in that it's technically Chinese, but it also exists under a bit of a one-country, two-system situation. Macau was handed back to China in 1999. When this occurred, Portugal gave full citizenship to every resident of Macau born before November 1981, when the negotiations had really started. Documents have recently come to light that show the British government lobbying Lisbon to change its position on the granting of citizenship. Not only did Britain not want Hong Kongers getting any ideas, but, and this is one of the most arrogant stories I've heard around British exceptionalism, and that says something, but also because Portuguese citizenship would mean that Macanese people would now have access to freedom of movement, and apparently, they would all move to the UK. I'm not making that up. The government memos literally highlight the fact that because of Portugal giving citizenship to Macanese people, the UK might soon be swamped with Asian immigrants. But Portugal ignored the UK's obnoxiousness and granted citizenship, giving the Macanese a sense of security in their new world. The UK actively refused to do the same for Hong Kongers. This August, MP Tom Tugendhat, the chair of the Common Foreign Affairs Committee, made a bit of a splash when he said that the UK should give British citizenship to Hong Kongers. Of course, there were a lot of the same superiority complex responses that came with the EU referendum in Turkey. If we give them access, they'll all come here. What utter nonsense. For example, do you know how many Romanians have taken advantage of freedom of movement? 16%. Not 100%, not 50%, not 20%. 16. And you know what else? The UK isn't even their top choice of country. Spain, Italy, and Germany all welcome more Romanians than does Britain. Even if Turkey ever does join the EU, which it probably won't, the vast majority will never leave, much less come to the UK, had Brexit not occurred. Of course not all 7 million Hong Kongers would move to the UK if they had passports, not even close. If you'll permit me to use the Romanian example again, not that many Romanians have come to the UK, and Hong Kong is wealthier and much further away than Romania, plus culturally much more different. The vast majority of people have no interest in ever leaving the place that they know, especially for somewhere so different. So calm your racist horses, Britain. But to have basically abandoned Hong Kongers to the desires of an authoritarian regime, and to have passed a Nationality Act partially to ensure that they remained where they are, it's really messed up, even for British standards. Especially when you look at those opinion polls in the faces of these protests. The young people of Hong Kong want international solidarity, and the country who they associate with the most should probably be at the top of that helping list. Now, I should say, Hong Kongers aren't completely abandoned. They can obtain British national overseas passports, which can be given to anybody who was a permanent resident of the city before 1997. In recent years, there has been an increase in these passports being granted as Hong Kongers search for international security. But those are not the same as citizenship. People who hold these passports are allowed to live in the UK for 6 months and are granted access to British embassies. That's it. So it's not exactly a tremendously useful status to have, all things considered. But it's something the British government grants to make itself feel as though it's thrown a bone to the people of Hong Kong, and I suppose any bone is still better than none. We all know that the UK isn't going to grant Hong Kongers citizenship. Unfortunately, even if xenophobic pandering wasn't an issue, with Brexit on the horizon and the loss of the EU's power, the UK can't risk upsetting China. As Chris Patten, Hong Kong's last governor, told The Guardian, "Are we more likely to take a firm line with China on trade issues, on economic issues, on political issues, on our own than we would within the EU? I don't think that the outlook outside of the European Union is one in which we are more likely to behave honorably towards Hong Kong than we have inside." So while the UK isn't going to make amends for its past, hopefully, dear listeners, you are at least now more aware of what is happening, not just to Hong Kongers, but to immigrants in general, because of the Nationality Acts passed in the 1980s and beyond. As always, I implore you, the British voter, to help those of us who have no voice in your electoral system in your country.
When was Freud broken? So we waited in the land to Atzelor's escabos from behind the copper chain. Most in shorts and t-shirts sat out in the sun. When I had Harry Albee, I may say, you better run. Oh, now Harry went on novice, and I didn't like his tone on that day in August, when the war came on. In front of line, a riot, coppers hammering their shields. Behind the pit stood silent sentry out across the field. When was we should sit down, then they couldn't pick a fight. But them who've been at our grave know that something wasn't right. And we'd had our share of stitches, our bruised and broken bones, before that day in August when the war came on. When Ellen broke, I scampered faster than I thought I could. When them down at the front were trapped and lay in their own blood, I saw the ones they talked about, no numbers on their shoulders, in uniforms that didn't fit, who looked a lot like soldiers. Oh, and I knew in that moment this went just to strike no more. She could stoop to send in men who kill to win a war. is a nice. The tires bend and glass smashed in this town. And the lamppost on the piddling corner, someone knocked it down. I watched Kitty lying, and I turned around to my wife. Said this is what it takes now, if you want a job for life. And to even make it this far, we sold everything we owned on that day in August when the war came on. Yeah, on that day in August when the war came home.
Keith, you are the Secretary of the People's Assembly for Scotland. Can you tell us what it is and what it does?
Okay, yeah, maybe just go back and say why we have a People's Assembly. I'm of an age where the link between the trade unions and the community was fairly tight, because essentially you had very little owner occupation. Most people lived in council houses, most people worked at their work, and most people worked in unionised workplaces. So I grew up in Rentrew, where we basically, you worked in Babcock's, you worked in Rolls Royce, or you worked in the yards. That was basically it. And every scheme in Rentrew, which probably had about 14,000 people living in when I was growing up in the late 50s, the secretary, the chair of almost every community association, every tenants association, was also a shop steward or a convener. So you had a situation that you had the kind of natural leadership of the community. We're bringing trade unions in to the community, and the community knew what was happening in industry, what was happening industrially and all the rest of it. It was sort of seamless, because shop stewards, as well as being shop stewards in their workplace, also became the letter writers, the people who you would go to if you needed somebody to advocate on your behalf with local council, the gas board or anybody else. And I know that would be sounds a wee kind of rose-tinted, but that was my experience. Like everything else that's bad in my life, we then come into Maggie Thatcher, who changed things forever. And we were put in a position where people started buying houses. And the other thing that was perhaps possibly by design, but possibly just by how an unintended consequence was, that people reached a point where they either had to buy their council house or they moved into the private sector. Because it used to be that council housing was financed by a block grant to the council. Mm-hmm. What Thatcher did was she removed that block grant to the council and individualised it, which meant essentially to get housing benefit and therefore low or no rent accommodation, yeah, it had to be very poor. And if you're in any form of work, it didn't make sense staying in a council house. I actually ended up being cheaper to move out of a council house in Rentrew and buy a flat in Glasgow at 16% interest rate, and it was cheaper as a working person with a family remaining in council accommodation. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the people who were involved in the tenants movement, the community movement, the natural leadership was torn away. So we had lost that relationship between the community and the trade unions. And what the People's Assembly is trying to do is bring together some of the expertise of the trade unions, some of the money of the trade unions, but also reconnect with our roots within working class and council house areas, people in benefits, people who are in struggle, who no longer have that natural relationship with the trade union movement. The People's Assembly in Scotland started in 2014, late in 2014. It's probably about a year after it did elsewhere in this island. And that was because in Scotland, folk had other things in their mind for two-thirds of 2014. So we came to it a wee bit later, but since then we have been active. It's mostly formed around trades councils. Every trades council, I think, is affiliated to the People's Assembly, but one of the things that's quite important is that we go into local groups and try and use the trades councils who are embedded in communities to get in further into communities. And what we've done is we've established what the concerns are, and we've used some of the expertise to produce stuff on poverty, how to deal with getting sanctioned, how to deal with the universal credit, how to find your way about it. In some areas, we have an advocacy service where people can actually represent you. In other places, it's more about distributing literature and directing you. One of the concerns about that is that we used to say in literature, we used to direct people to the CAB. But we're now in a situation in Scotland where the CAB are now doing the assessment on behalf of the DWP. They've got a contract for universal credit. So that's what's happening within the localities. It's a general anti-austerity. The full title is the People's Assembly Against Austerity in Scotland. So we've been involved in closing Amazon, which highlighted an interesting issue in that we closed Amazon, blocking streets, and then found out that the only police provision in Fife, we were in Dunfermline, the only police provision in Fife that day was in Glenrothes, which meant after 45 minutes of closing it, we were getting fed up and the police still hadn't arrived. But we had to wait till the police arrived before, so we could be put off the road. We're involved, so at different levels, we're involved about rents, we're involved about cuts in services. We're also advising some communities where, in some areas like some Western Bartonshire, where councils are trying to offload community facilities onto the community under the guise of community empowerment. But what they're doing is they're giving them premises, they're giving them liabilities, they're not giving them staff, and they're not giving them finance to house staff. So where there was previous paid jobs, what we have is communities having to do it on a voluntary basis. And that's got health and safety implications, it's got cleanliness implications, it's got all sorts of implications. And also, communities shouldn't be in the case of, if you like, cutting their own throat and getting rid of the services that they should reasonably expect. We have a steering committee, and perhaps uniquely in Scotland, we have membership of that steering committee goes from the Labour Party campaign for socialism, and we also have the SNP trade union group. We have all of the major trade unions in Scotland, with the exception probably of EIS and the GMB, though we do cooperate with like EIS using some of their research and stuff. We had a Summer of Poverty campaign, and a lot of the information, a lot of the knowledge and stats about that came from a survey that EIS did a couple of years ago, where they canvassed their members and came up with all sorts of things. That was how people were suffering and disappearing for a couple of weeks when they'd all fit in clothes until folk got the money together to get replacement clothing. Maybe thinking about, you know, no mention when you come back for your holidays, asking kids to write, what did you do in your holidays? Because they maybe hadn't done very much except being in the house or go to the local shops. Also, as part of that Summer of Poverty thing, is we found out that Glasgow City Council actually did away with the free swimming for young people under 16. They did away for free swimming for pensioners. Ironically, on the same day as the Scottish Government launched their obesity strategy. So we were highlighting the contradiction that exists in that. So it's about a consciousness awareness campaign. It's about a campaign to try and help people who are suffering the most, and also about bringing people into the trade union's orbit, so that if they do get into employment, if the situation changes, they know that we are on side and the need for that. We've cooperated with Betland Zero and the various different campaigns against precarious work. We've been involved with Deliveroo drivers along, and we found out just how horrific the delivery driver situation was, and we've tried to highlight that, where you've got the situation that when you phone up for a takeaway meal, they charge you £3.50. I had always assumed that went to the rider. In actual fact, what it turns out is they then put that out to the riders, and they bid for it, if you like, and the lowest, you know, it's the race to the bottom. So it's quite literally the old on the waterfront thing of throwing the tokens on the ground. So we've given some advice to try and, you know, lift some of the men and women who are forced into that situation. So it's as broad as it wants to be, it's as broad as we can be, but it can only exist because of the support of the trade unions and the individuals coming together in that campaign. In some areas we've been very successful in raising community awareness and getting community activity, places like Fife. Interestingly enough, in the big cities is where it's been hardest, the Glasgow and the Edinburghs, because I think there's a lot of stuff going on, but it's not on a coordinated basis. What I would say is that for Unite, when they set up an advice thing for members in terms of universal credit, because a lot of folk in universal credit are also in employment, you know, so therefore there's a question about how they balance their work and their benefits and all the rest of it. In actual fact, the Unite community branch just basically accepted 100% of the materials that we put together, and that was further extended, it needed a wee bit adaptation, and that's now getting used by Unite throughout England and Wales as well. So it's a good example, if you like, that of taking the expertise, taking some of the money into communities and bringing folk back into orbit. That's why the People's Assembly exists. We started off with big demonstrations, marches to George Square and so on and so forth, but it's now a bit more localised, not low-key, but a bit more closer to where the greatest need is.
Okay, thank you very much. And here's a bonus of our discussion about delivery workers after that.
Absolutely.
I commuted the GFT one day, and Lorraine was going to, wherever her car was, I said, I'll just wait here, and she went to get the car. And there was all this group in Blythewood Square. I think it was only one lassie there, and I was just talking about this year, and that was what they were saying. And there was one boy who was telling us, and I was saying, well, why don't you just arrange? Because what happens with delivery, you come in, you clock in, but when the phone rings and say, I'm available, and I'm in, you know, Blythewood Square. So therefore, all the Chinese, Indians, everything, even Burger King and that deliver, they then put out, right, we've got a delivery to Toon Heed, and you bid to get that job.
What do you mean? How do they bid for? Who? Cash?
Oh. No, just say, I'll do it for 10
I'll
pounds.
Do it for 10, Bob, or I'll do it for £3. I said, well, why do we just all get together and say, right, the first one, you say £3.50 and the rest is say nothing. And the next one, you say £3.50 and the rest is say nothing.
Fucking shocking, us.
Forevermore, for all to sing along. This is Em Dehaney, back on the Ungagged podcast. Where have I been? Well, you might not know that as well as writing and recording my trademark feminist rants for Ungagged and having two kids and a job, I somehow find time to write fiction, mainly horror and fantasy, and be the partner in an independent horror and poetry publishing house. So far, so la-di-da. But I've been reading a few things online recently about diverse representation in publishing, particularly in horror anthologies, as those are the circles that I move in, but not exclusively, and how the best talent will rise to the top regardless, and how positive discrimination isn't to be encouraged because it will dilute the talent pool. And at first, I bit my online tongue. I wasn't going to write about this. I wasn't going to podcast about this. I try and stay out of online drama, believe it or not. I don't want to jump in on anyone's argument thread. I've had a man on Twitter tell me he hoped I would get cancer, and I've been told I'm a libtard and a feminazi and a social justice warrior and a snowflake and all those other silly supposed insults that many of us wear as a badge of honour. I don't want to be the victim of a pylon, but this is something I feel I need to say. Now, this is not directed at any one writer, person, publisher, thing, company, or unnameable entity, but I'm sure many of you reading this will have also read or heard similar things on the socials. We can all laugh and make jokes about how there isn't enough representation of one-legged pirates or cat lovers or people who like pineapple on pizza, but I would like to say this very loud so that everyone can hear. Without positive discrimination in the arts, without actively pursuing women writers, queer writers, black writers, Asian writers, deaf writers, writers in wheelchairs, writers with ADHD, writers from non-English speaking countries, basically any writer who lives a different experience to you, and more importantly to the gatekeepers of the arts and media, then those writers rarely get a voice. They didn't at all until recently because of, guess what? Their voices being actively sought out. The BBC only appointed its first diversity officer in 2001 after Director General Greg Dyke's confession that the Beeb was hideously white. Now, I'm not saying that pushing these voices should be at the expense of talent, but straight white males don't have the monopoly on talent anymore. I mean, they never did. They just wouldn't let anyone get a word in edgewise. Like I said, this is 100% not directed at anyone in particular. It is just a debate I have been seeing a lot online at the moment, and not just in publishing. Women are not a minority group. They are 50% of the world population. So why don't they get 50% of the representation in music festivals? Why do commercial rock radio playlists feature only 5% female artists? Why has only one female director ever won an Academy Award? Why has there never been a black Oscar-winning director and only 6 black nominees? Some of my favourite films from the last couple of years, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Black Panther, Get Out and Moonlight, were created by black writers, black directors and black actors, and these stories would never have even seen the light of day a few years ago. They would have been considered too niche, too black for the mainstream, and for mainstream, read white. Think about the recent episode of TV panel show 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown, which was exclusively female. Twitter went mad. This was an event, a big deal, the end of the world, according to some idiots. But panel shows used to be exclusively male all the time, and no one batted an eyelid. The odd token woman was allowed on, just so that people could say they don't find female comedians funny. But now there does appear to be more and more diverse representation on shows like Taskmaster and Have I Got News For You. Cats Does Countdown only last week featured Rosie Jones, a comedian with cerebral palsy, who was hilarious, I might add. This does not happen by accident. This does not happen organically. This happens because the gatekeepers make a concerted effort to be more diverse. Now, I know that positive discrimination when it comes to employment law is currently prohibited under the Equality Act, and I'm mainly talking about inclusion in the arts here, not employment quotas for protected characteristics, but maybe it's about time that this be scrutinised and questioned as well. If music festivals are being encouraged to make their lineups 50% female, why aren't the boards of multinational companies doing the same thing? Why can't police forces be pushed to hire more ethnically diverse staff? Why isn't politics, which is still the domain of huge numbers of white men who all went to the same schools and universities, are in the same private clubs and all adhere to the same worldview, subject to race, gender and class quotas reflecting the populace they are supposed to represent? Because make no mistake, positive discrimination happens despite all the European human rights equality laws in the world. The fact remains that one social group, middle class white men, have enjoyed positive discrimination for years. I'm now going to quote a quote about quotas from the excellent book The Guilty Feminist by Deborah Frances White, based on her podcast of the same name. Most industries include many more men than women in their decision-making processes. One way to make up for a huge historical handicap is to create quotas. In 2016, Germany enforced quotas requiring that corporations make their boards at least 30% female. There was a horrified outcry about this quota, as there always is when the topic arises, from both men and women. Women who didn't want to feel like the token woman at the table or to take a place they hadn't earned. The very existence of the debate about quotas highlights society's blindness to the over-inclusion of white men at the expense of women and people of colour, and women of colour in particular. White then goes on to detail the industries and arenas that were exclusively male, and for that read, for the most part, exclusively white male, until recent times. The gender quota for actors in England was 100% male until 1662. Gender quotas have been 100% male around the world until, in some cases, shockingly recently, for voting. Swiss women couldn't even vote on some issues until the 1990s. The gender quota for American astronauts was originally 100%, even though some female trainees scored higher than their male counterparts. And don't forget, women have only just been allowed to drive in the United Arab Emirates. A Mumsnet poll of more than 400 people involved in recruitment found that 28% had heard someone who was responsible for hiring say that given the choice between an equally capable man and woman, they would always choose the man, the very definition of positive discrimination. And quotas do work. In Norway, representation on corporate boards went up from 9% when quotas were introduced in 2003 to 40% 10 years later. Doctors used to be 100% male. Lawyers used to be 100% male. But do you think that women should not be doctors? That women can't be lawyers? Of course not. That seems ridiculous. But it was only through the actions of key individuals, awkward, angry individuals pushing their voices to the front, going against the status quo and enabling others to follow after, that change happens. Now think about Formula One racing drivers, jockeys, the SAS. Do women not deserve places at those tables? Can they do just as good a job as the men? If not, why not? Remember, people used to think the same about female doctors, about female astronauts, about women voting, about women acting, about women writing or painting or being architects or basically doing anything other than homemaking, childbearing and the occasional bit of needlepoint. So maybe, just maybe, positive discrimination isn't something to be feared and derided. We all gain from hearing diverse voices. We all gain from new perspectives and ideas and experiences. Now, I'm just one half of a teeny tiny indie publisher, the smallest of minnows. I'm not even in the pond. I'm in a tiny bucket at the bottom of the garden. If I flick my tail really hard and jump up, I can just about see the pond. But I always have the conscious thought in my head that I don't want our books to be a middle-class white sausage fest. And I try my hardest to make this not the case. Okay, we never have a 50-50 ratio, but at Bedizzo Books, we do try and be diverse. We do actively pursue writers who are from a broader spectrum. If everyone did this, rather than crowing about SJWs and political correctness gone mad, then we all gain. Diversity in the arts and elsewhere only comes when those voices are deliberately pushed to the front. You might not like it, especially if you're not one of those voices, But that's life. It never used to be that way, and it isn't always that way now. But things are changing. And change is good.